Chapter 11. The Lowly Stamp of Their Origin. Religion's Corrupt Beginnings. Where questions of religion are concerned, people are guilty of every possible sort of dishonesty and intellectual misdemeanor. Sigmund Freud, The Future of an Illusion. The various forms of worship which prevailed in the Roman world were all considered by the people to be equally true, by the philosopher as equally false, and by the magistrate as equally useful. Edward Gibbon, Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. An old popular saying from Chicago has it that if you want to maintain your respect for city aldermen, or your appetite for sausages, you should take care not to be present when the former are being groomed or the latter are being manufactured. It is the anatomy of man, said Engels, that is the key to the anatomy of the ape. Thus, if we watch the process of a religion in its formation, we can make some assumptions about the origins of those religions that were put together before most people could read. From a wide selection of openly manufactured sausage religions, I shall pick the Melanesian cargo cult, the Pentecostal superstar Marjo, and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, commonly known as the Mormons. The thought has surely occurred to many people throughout the ages, what if there is an afterlife but no God? What if there is a God but no afterlife? As far as I know, the clearest writer to give expression to this problem was Thomas Hobbes, in his 1651 masterwork, Leviathan. I strongly recommend that you read Part 3, Chapter 38, and Part 4, Chapter 44, for yourselves, because Hobbes's command of both Holy Scripture and the English language is quite breathtaking. He also reminds us how perilous it was, and always has been, even to think about these things. His brisk and ironic throat-clearing is eloquent in itself. Reflecting on the nonsense story of Adam's fall, the original instance of someone being created free and then loaded with impossible-to-obey prohibitions, Hobbes opined, not forgetting fearfully to add that he did so with submission nevertheless, both in this and in all questions, whereof the determination dependeth on the Scriptures, that if Adam was condemned to death by sinning, his death must have been postponed, since he contrived to raise a large posterity before actually dying. Having planted the subversive thought that forbidding Adam to eat from one tree lest he die, and from another lest he live forever, is absurd and contradictory, Hobbes was forced to imagine alternative scriptures and even alternative punishments and alternative eternities. His point was that people might not obey the rule of men if they were more afraid of divine retribution than of horrible death in the here and now. But he had acknowledged the process whereby people are always free to make up a religion that suits or gratifies or flatters them. Samuel Butler was to adapt this idea in his Erewhon Revisited. In the original Erewhon, Mr. Higgs pays a visit to a remote country from which he eventually makes his escape in a balloon. Returning 2 decades later, he finds that in his absence he has become a god, named the Sun Child, worshipped on the day he ascended into heaven. 2 high priests are on hand to celebrate the ascension, and when Higgs threatens to expose them and reveal himself as a mere mortal, he's told, "You must not do that, because all the morals of this country abound around this myth, and if they once know that you did not ascend into heaven, they will all become wicked." In 1964 there appeared a celebrated documentary movie called Mondo Carne, or The World of the Dog, in which the directors captured numerous human cruelties and illusions. This was the first occasion on which one could see a new religion being assembled, in plain view, on camera. The inhabitants of the Pacific Islands may have been separated for centuries from the more economically developed world, but when visited by the fatal impact, many of them were shrewd enough to get the point immediately. Here were great vessels with billowing sails, bearing treasures and weapons and devices that were beyond any compare. Some of the more untutored islanders did what many people do when confronted with a new phenomenon, and tried to translate it into a discourse that they could themselves understand. Not unlike those fearful Aztecs who, first seeing mounted Spanish soldiers in Mesoamerica, concluded that they had a centaur for an enemy. These poor souls decided that the Westerners were their long-mourned ancestors, come back at last with goods from beyond the grave. That illusion cannot long have survived the encounter with the colonists, but later it was observed in several places that the brighter islanders had a better idea. Docks and jetties were built, they noticed, after which more ships came and unloaded more goods. Acting by analogy and mimesis, the locals constructed their own jetties and waited for these, too, to attract some ships. Futile as this proceeding was, it badly retarded the advance of later Christian missionaries. When they made their appearance, they were asked where the gifts were, and soon came up with some trinkets. In the 20th century, the cargo cult revived in an even more impressive and touching form. Units of the United States Armed Forces, arriving in the Pacific to build airfields for the war on Japan, found that they were the objects of slavish emulation. Local enthusiasts abandoned their lightly worn Christian observances and devoted all their energies to the construction of landing strips that might attract loaded airplanes. They made simulated antennae out of bamboo. They built and lit fires to simulate the flares that guided the American planes to land. This still goes on, which is the saddest bit of the Mondo Carne sequence. On the island of Tana, an American GI was declared to be the Redeemer. His name, John Frum, seems to have been an invention too. But even after the last serviceman flew or sailed away after 1945, the eventual return of the Savior Frum was preached and predicted, and an annual ceremony still bears his name. On another island named New Britain, adjacent to Papua New Guinea, the cult is even more strikingly analogous. It has 10 commandments, the 10 laws, a trinity that has one presence in heaven and another on earth, and a ritual system of paying tributes in the hope of propitiating these authorities. If the ritual is performed with sufficient purity and fervor, so its adherents believe, then an age of milk and honey will be ushered in. This radiant future, sad to say, is known as the period of the companies and will cause New Britain to flourish and prosper as if it were a multinational corporation. Some people may be insulted at even the suggestion of a comparison here, but are not the holy books of official monotheism absolutely dripping with material yearning and with admiring, almost mouth-watering descriptions of Solomon's wealth, the thriving flocks and herds of the faithful, the rewards for a good Muslim in paradise, to say nothing of many, many lurid tales of plunder and spoils? Jesus, it is true, shows no personal interest in gain, but he does speak of treasure in heaven and even of mansions as an inducement to follow him. Is it not further true that all religions down the ages have shown a keen interest in the amassment of material goods in the real world? The thirst for money and worldly comfort is only a subtext of the mind-numbing story of Marjo Gortner, the infant phenomenon of American evangelical hucksterism. Grotesquely christened Marjo, a cretinous lumping together of the names Mary and Joseph, by his parents, young Master Gortner was thrust into the pulpit at the age of 4, dressed in a revolting little Lord Fauntleroy suit, and told to say that he'd been divinely commanded to preach. If he complained or cried, his mother would hold him under the water tap or press a cushion on his face, always being careful, as he relates it, to leave no marks. Trained like a seal, he soon attracted the cameras, and by the age of 6 was officiating at the weddings of grown-ups. His celebrity spread, and many flocked to see the miraculous child. His best guess is that he raised $3 million in contributions, none of which was earmarked for his education or his own future. At the age of 17, he rebelled against his pitiless and cynical parents and dropped out into the early 60s California counterculture. In the immortal Christmas children's pantomime Peter Pan, there comes a climactic moment when the little angel Tinkerbell seems to be dying. The glowing light that represents her on the stage begins to dim, and there is only one possible way to save the dire situation. An actor steps up to the front of the house and asks all the children, "Do you believe in fairies?" If they keep confidently answering yes, then the tiny light will start to brighten again. Who can object to this? One wants not to spoil children's belief in magic. There will be plenty of time later for disillusionment. And nobody is waiting at the exit, asking them hoarsely to contribute their piggy banks to the Tinkerbell Salvation Church. The events at which Marjo was exploited had all the intellectual content of the Tinkerbell scene, nastily combined with the ethics of Captain Hook. A decade or so later, Mr. Gortner exacted the best possible revenge for his stolen and empty childhood, and decided to do the general public a favour in order to make up for his conscious fraudulence. He invited a film crew to follow him as he ostensibly returned to preach the gospel, and took the trouble to explain how all the tricks are pulled. "This is how you induce motherly women," he was a handsome lad, "to part with their savings. This is how you time the music to create an ecstatic effect. This is when you speak of how Jesus visited you personally. Here is how you put invisible ink on your forehead in the shape of a cross, so that it will suddenly show up when you start perspiring. This is when you really move in for the kill." He keeps all his promises, telling the film's directors in advance what he can and will do, and then going out into the auditorium to enact it with absolute conviction. People weep and yell and collapse in spasms and fits, shrieking their saviour's name. Cynical, coarse, brutish old men and women wait for the psychological moment to demand money, and start counting it gleefully before the charade of the service is even over. Occasionally one sees the face of a small child, dragged to the tent, and looking wretched and uncomfortable, as its parents writhe and moan and give away their hard-won pay. One knew, of course, that the whole racket of American evangelism was just that, a heartless con run by the second-string characters from Chaucer's Pardoner's Tale. You saps keep the faith, we'll just keep the money. And this is what it must have been like when indulgences were openly sold in Rome, and when a nail or a splinter from the crucifixion could fetch a nice price in any flea market in Christendom. But to see the crime exposed by someone who is both a victim and a profiteer is nonetheless quite shocking even to a hardened unbeliever. After such knowledge, what forgiveness? The film Marjo won an Academy Award in 1972 and has made absolutely no difference at all. The mills of the TV preachers continue to grind, and the poor continue to finance the rich, just as if the glittering temples and palaces of Las Vegas had been built by the money of those who won, rather than those who lost. In his bewitching novel, The Child in Time, Ian McEwan gives us a desolate character and narrator who is reduced by tragedy to a near-inert state, in which he vacantly watches a great deal of daytime TV. Observing the way in which his fellow creatures allow themselves, volunteer themselves, to be manipulated and humiliated, he coins the phrase for those who indulge themselves in witnessing the spectacle. It is, he decides, the Democrats' pornography. It is not snobbish to notice the way in which people show their gullibility and their herd instinct and their wish, or perhaps their need, to be credulous and to be fooled. This is an ancient problem. Credulity may be a form of innocence and even innocuous in itself, but it provides a standing invitation for the wicked and the clever to exploit their brothers and sisters, and is thus one of humanity's great vulnerabilities. No honest account of the growth and persistence of religion, or the reception of miracles and revelations, is possible without reference to this stubborn fact. If the followers of the Prophet Muhammad hope to put an end to any future revelations after the Immaculate Conception of the Quran, they reckoned without the founder of what is now one of the world's fastest-growing faiths, and they did not foresee, how could they, mammals as they were, that the prophet of this ridiculous cult would model himself on theirs. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, hereafter known as the Mormons, was founded by a gifted opportunist who, despite couching his text in openly plagiarized Christian terms, announced that, "I shall be to this generation a new Muhammad," and adopted as his fighting slogan the words which he thought he'd learned from Islam, "Either the Al-Quran or the sword." He was too ignorant to know that if you use the word Al, you do not need another definite article, but then he did resemble Muhammad in being able only to make a borrowing out of other people's Bibles. In March 1826, a court in Bainbridge, New York, convicted a 21-year-old man of being a disorderly person and an imposter. That ought to have been all we ever heard of Joseph Smith, who at trial admitted to defrauding citizens by organizing mad gold-digging expeditions and also to claiming to possess dark or necromantic powers. However, within 4 years he was back in the local newspapers, all of which one may still read, as the discoverer of the Book of Mormon. He had two huge local advantages which most mountebanks and charlatans do not possess. First, he was operating in the same hectically pious district that gave us the Shakers, the previously mentioned George Miller, who repeatedly predicted the end of the world, and several other self-proclaimed American prophets. So notorious did this local tendency become that the region became known as the Burned-Over District, in honor of the way in which it had surrendered to one religious craze after another. Second, he was operating in an area which, unlike large tracts of the newly opening North America, did possess the signs of an ancient history. A vanished and vanquished Indian civilization had bequeathed a considerable number of burial mounds, which, when randomly and amateurishly desecrated, were found to contain not merely bones, but also quite advanced artifacts of stone, copper, and beaten silver. There were 8 of these sites, within 12 miles of the underperforming farm, which the Smith family called home. There were 2 equally stupid schools or factions who took a fascinated interest in such matters. The first were the gold diggers and treasure diviners, who brought their magic sticks and crystals and stuffed toads to bear in the search for lucre, and the second, those who hoped to find the resting place of a lost tribe of Israel. Smith's cleverness was to be a member of both groups, and to unite cupidity with half-baked anthropology. The actual story of the imposture is almost embarrassing to read, and almost embarrassingly easy to uncover. It has been best told by Dr. Fawn Brodie, whose 1945 book No Man Knows My History was a good faith attempt by a professional historian to put the kindest possible interpretation on the relevant events. In brief, Joseph Smith announced that he had been visited, three times, as is customary, by an angel named Moroni. The said angel informed him of a book written upon gold plates, which explained the origins of those living on the North American continent, as well as the truths of the gospel. There were, further, two magic stones set in the twin breastplates Urim and Thummim of the Old Testament that would enable Smith himself to translate the aforesaid book. After many wrestlings, he brought this buried apparatus home with him on September the 21st, 1827, about 18 months after his conviction for fraud. He then set about producing a translation. The resulting books turned out to be a record set down by ancient prophets, beginning with Nephi, son of Lehi, who had fled Jerusalem in approximately 600 BC and come to America. Many battles, curses, and afflictions accompanied their subsequent wanderings, and those of their numerous progeny. How did the books turn out to be this way? Smith refused to show the golden plates to anybody, claiming that for other eyes to view them would mean death. But he encountered a problem that will be familiar to students of Islam. He was extremely glib and fluent as a debater and story weaver, as many accounts attest. But he was illiterate, at least in the sense that while he could read a little, he could not write. A scribe was therefore necessary to take his inspired dictation. This scribe was at first his wife Emma, and then, when more hands were necessary, a luckless neighbour named Martin Harris. Hearing Smith cite the words of Isaiah 29, verses 11 to 12, concerning the repeated injunction to read, Harris mortgaged his farm to help in the task and moved in with the Smiths. He sat on one side of a blanket hung across the kitchen, and Smith sat on the other with his translation stones, intoning through the blanket. As if to make this an even happier scene, Harris was warned that if he tried to glimpse the plates or look at the prophet, he'd be struck dead. Mrs. Harris was having none of this, and was already furious with the fecklessness of her husband. She stole the first 116 pages, and challenged Smith to reproduce them, as presumably, given his power of revelation, he could. Determined women like this appear far too seldom in the history of religion. After a very bad few weeks, the ingenious Smith countered with another revelation. He could not replicate the original, which might be in the devil's hands by now and open to a satanic verse's interpretation. But the all-foreseeing Lord had, meanwhile, furnished some smaller plates, indeed the very plates of Nephi, which told a fairly similar tale. With infinite labour, the translation was resumed, with new scriveners behind the blanket as occasion demanded, and when it was completed, all the original golden plates were transported to heaven, where apparently they remain to this day. Mormon partisans sometimes say, as do Muslims, that this cannot have been fraudulent because the work of deception would have been too much for one poor and illiterate man. They have on their side two useful points. If Muhammad was ever convicted in public of fraud and attempted necromancy, we have no record of the fact, and Arabic is a language that is somewhat opaque even to the fairly fluent outsider. However, we know the Quran to be made up in part of earlier books and stories, and in the case of Smith it is likewise a simple if tedious task to discover that 25,000 words of the Book of Mormon are taken directly from the Old Testament. These words can mainly be found in the chapters of Isaiah available in Ethan Smith's View of the Hebrews, the 10 Tribes of Israel in America. This then popular work by a pious loony, claiming that the American Indians originated in the Middle East, seems to have started the other Smith on his gold digging in the first place. A further 2,000 words of the Book of Mormon are taken from the New Testament. Of the 350 names in the book, more than 100 come straight from the Bible, and 100 more are as near stolen as makes no difference. The great Mark Twain famously referred to it as chloroform in print, but I accuse him of hitting too soft a target, since the book does actually contain the Book of Ether. The words, "and it came to pass," can be found at least 2,000 times, which does admittedly have a soporific effect. Quite recent scholarship has exposed every single other Mormon document as at best a scrawny compromise and at worst a pitiful fake, as Dr. Brody was obliged to notice when she reissued and updated her remarkable book in 1973. Like Muhammad, Smith could produce divine revelations at short notice and often simply to suit himself, especially, and like Muhammad, when he wanted a new girl and wished to take her as another wife. As a result, he overreached himself and came to a violent end, having meanwhile excommunicated almost all the poor men who had been his first disciples, and who had been browbeaten into taking his dictation. Still, this story raises some very absorbing questions concerning what happens when a plain racket turns into a serious religion before our eyes. Professor Daniel Dennett and his supporters have attracted a great deal of criticism for their natural science explanation of religion. Never mind the supernatural, argues Dennett. We may discard that while accepting that there have always been those for whom belief in belief is a good thing in itself. Phenomena can be explained in biological terms. In primitive times, is it not possible that those who believed in the shaman's cure had a better morale as a result, and thus a slightly but significantly higher chance of actually being cured? Miracles, and similar nonsense to one side, not even modern medicine rejects this thought. And it seems possible, moving into the psychological arena, that people can be better off believing in something than in nothing, however untrue that something may be. Some of this will always be disputed among anthropologists and other scientists, but what interests me, and always has, is this. Do the preachers and prophets also believe, or do they too just believe in belief? Do they ever think to themselves, this is too easy? And do they then rationalize the trick by saying either A, if these wretches weren't listening to me, they'd be in even worse shape, or B, that if it doesn't do them any good, then it still can't be doing them much harm? Sir James Frazer, in his famous study of religion and magic, The Golden Bough, suggests that the novice witch doctor is better off if he does not share the illusions of the ignorant congregation. For one thing, if he does take the magic literally, he's much more likely to make a career-ending mistake. Better by far to be a cynic, and to rehearse the contrary, and to tell himself that everybody is better off in the end. Smith obviously seems like a mere cynic, in that he was never happier than when using his revelation to claim supreme authority, or to justify the idea that the flock should make over their property to him, or to sleep with every available woman. There are gurus and cult leaders of that kind born every day. Smith must certainly have thought it was too easy to get innocent wretches like Martin Harris to believe everything he told them, especially when they were thirsty for just a glimpse of that mouth-watering golden trove. But was there a moment when he also believed that he did have a destiny and was ready to die to prove it? In other words, was he a huckster all the time, or was there a pulse inside him somewhere? The study of religion suggests to me that while it cannot possibly get along without great fraud and also minor fraud, this remains a fascinating and somewhat open question. There were dozens of part-educated, unscrupulous, ambitious, fanatical men like Smith in the Palmyra, New York area at that epoch, but only one of them achieved takeoff. This is for two probable reasons. First, and by all accounts, including those of his enemies, Smith had great natural charm and authority and fluency, what Max Weber called the charismatic part of leadership. Second, there were at that time a great number of people hungry for soil and a new start in the West, constituting a huge latent force behind the notion of a new leader, let alone a new holy book, that could augur a promised land. The wanderings of the Mormons in Missouri and Illinois and Utah, and the massacres that they both suffered and inflicted on the way, gave body and sinew to the idea of martyrdom and exile, and to the idea of the Gentiles, as they scornfully called the unbelievers. It is a great historical story, and, unlike its origin in a piece of vulgar fabrication, can be read with respect. It does, however, have two indelible stains. The first is the sheer obviousness and crudity of its revelations, which were opportunistically improvised by Smith and later by his successors as they went along. And the second is its revoltingly crude racism. Christian preachers of all kinds had justified slavery until the American Civil War and even afterwards, on the supposed biblical warrant that of the three sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Ham had been cursed and cast into servitude. But Joseph Smith took this nasty fable even further, fulminating in his Book of Abraham that the swarthy races of Egypt had inherited this very curse. Also, at the made-up Battle of Cumorah, a site located conveniently near his own birthplace, the Nephites, described as fair-skinned and handsome, contended against the Lamanites, whose descendants were punished with dark pigment for turning away from God. As the crisis over American slavery mounted, Smith and his even more dubious disciples preached against the abolitionists in antebellum Missouri. They solemnly said that there had been a third group in heaven during the ultimate battle between God and Lucifer. This group, as it was explained, had tried to remain neutral, but after Lucifer's defeat they had been forced into the world, compelled to take bodies in the accursed lineage of Canaan, and hence the Negro or African race. Thus, when Dr. Brody first wrote her book, No black American was allowed to hold even the lowly position of deacon, let alone a priesthood, in the Mormon Church. Nor were the descendants of Ham admitted to the sacred rites of the temple. If anything proves the human manufacture of religion, it is the way that the Mormon elders resolve this difficulty. Confronted by the plain words of one of their holy books, and the increasing contempt and isolation that it imposed upon them, they did as they had done when their fondness for polygamy would have brought federal retribution upon God's own Utah. They had still another revelation, and more or less in time for the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1965, had it divinely disclosed to them that black people were human, after all. It must be said for the Latter-day Saints, these conceited words were added to Smith's original Church of Jesus Christ in 1833, that they have squarely faced one of the great difficulties of revealed religion. This is the problem of what to do about those who were born before the exclusive revelation, or who died without ever having the opportunity to share in its wonders. Christians used to resolve this problem by saying that Jesus descended into hell after his crucifixion, where it is thought that he saved or converted the dead. There is indeed a fine passage in Dante's Inferno where he comes to rescue the spirits of great men like Aristotle, who had presumably been boiling away for centuries until he got round to them. In another less ecumenical scene from the same book, the Prophet Muhammad is found being disemboweled in revolting detail. The Mormons have improved on this rather backdated solution with something very literal-minded. They have assembled a gigantic genealogical database at a huge repository in Utah, and are busy filling it with the names of all people whose births, marriages, and deaths have been tabulated since records began. This is very useful if you want to look up your own family tree, and as long as you do not object to having your ancestors becoming Mormons. Every week, at special ceremonies in Mormon temples, the congregations meet and are given a certain quota of names of the departed to pray in to their church. This retrospective baptism of the dead seems harmless enough to me, but the American Jewish Committee became incensed when it was discovered that the Mormons had acquired the records of the Nazi final solution, and were industriously baptizing what for once could truly be called a lost tribe, the murdered Jews of Europe. For all its touching inefficacy, this exercise seemed in poor taste. I sympathize with the American Jewish Committee, but I nonetheless think that the followers of Mr. Smith should be congratulated for hitting upon even the most simple-minded technological answer to a problem that has defied solution ever since man first invented religion.